Today is Wednesday, September 28th. We're going to work on lymphatic system and a review for exam two.
Okay, so just to review bulk fluid transport at capillaries, let's talk about the types of pressures that help to regulate fluid transport here. So we've got two pressures to mind. We have hydrostatic pressure and we have osmotic pressure. Which one of those is most related to blood pressure?
Hydrostatic,
good. And hydro and hydrostatic reminds us that particular pressure is based upon
water.
Good. That's the fluid or water in your bloodstream. The osmotic pressure that battles hydrostatic pressure is based upon solutes and proteins. So osmotic pressure doesn't push fluids, rather it pulls. Good. Pulls those fluids. So we actually have a battle that's been set up. We have a push-pull battle set up at each end of our capillary. Coming into the arterial end of the capillary, you'll notice we've got a much higher blood pressure. That BHP value is around 35 millimeters mercury coming into this end of the capillary. Because it's hydrostatic pressure, does it tend to push or pull fluids?
Push.
It's pushing, good. And so we battle an osmotic pressure created by salts and proteins. That particular pressure is inside the capillary and pulling with around 26 millimeters mercury. Like we talked on Tuesday, the higher number wins the battle. So which pressure wins the overall push-pull battle?
Hydrostatic.
Hydrostatic, good. So the process of pushing those fluids out is known as?
Filtration.
All right, and so we end up pushing blood plasma into the interstitial space, and so this blood plasma actually becomes part of your interstitial fluid. Well, we talked about a leaky hose. If you constantly push fluids out of your capillary and those fluids leak into your interstitial space, you eventually lose pressure. Which pressure declines over the length of the capillary?
Hydrostatic
pressure, good. So by the time you reach the venule end of your capillary, you'll notice that blood pressure, or blood hydrostatic pressure, is around 15 to 17 millimeters mercury. That's going to battle the same constant osmotic pressure of 26. Like we talked earlier, the higher of these two numbers wins the battle. And so what happens to fluids now?
Pulled back in,
yeah, so they're reabsorbed. So these fluids that escape to the interstitial space are now reabsorbed back into the capillary, and that's pretty much an effective process for pushing out fluids and then pulling them back in. I should tell you this. This process only reabsorbs 90% of what you pushed out, only 90%. So that means about 10% of your fluids that you filtered out in the first place get left in the interstitial space. The reason we kind of figure this out is at this arterial end of your capillary, your net filtration pressure is around positive 10 millimeters mercury. But once you reach the venule end of the capillary, this bracket gives us negative 7. We used negative 8 in class on Tuesday. That negative 8 value is opposite, but not quite the same as the positive 10 pushing out. If it was a push of positive 10 at the arterial end and a pull of negative 10 down here at the venule end, then we would assume that we are pushing and pulling with equal force, but we're not. So we have to account for those excess fluids left in the interstitial space. All right, so why don't we go over the questions then in your course pack. I believe that was page 59. Have you guys had a chance to work through and complete those?
Some of them?
Okay. Got some questions on them. Okay, first one there says, how does blood hydrostatic pressure change from the arterial end to the venule end of your capillary?
It decreases at the venule end.
Yeah, good. It decreases, or you could say it declines. Do you know the why behind that? And the drop in pressure is due to?
Holes in the capillary.
Yeah. Yeah, we're moving high pressure to low pressure. We're pushing fluids out into the interstitial space. And so we're losing the very thing, the fluid that created the pressure in the first place.
Okay,
repeat that one. Okay, so the fact that you're pushing fluids out, the fluids are what creates your hydrostatic pressure in the first place. And if you're pushing those fluids out like crazy, then you're going to start losing pressure. It's just like having a tire full of nail holes. All right, let's see. Number two there says the drop in what pressure allows interstitial fluid to return to the venule end of your capillary?
Hydrostatic,
good. Drop in hydrostatic pressure, or BHP for short. Number three, what effect do plasma proteins, such as albumin, have on fluids in the interstitial space?
It pulls the fluid into the capillary.
Yeah, pulls the fluid. So those fluids in the interstitial space are sucked back into that capillary. They're pulled back into the capillary. Number four, why does fluid return to the capillary at the venous end or venule end and not at the arterial end?
Because the BHP pressure is much higher at the arterial end than the venous end.
Yeah, you got higher BHP at your arterial end than you do at the venule end. Okay, you got a higher BHP at the arterial end than you do at the venule end. So number five leads us into today's discussion. What happens to any fluids that are not picked up at the venous end of the capillary? Yeah, they remain in the interstitial fluid. Those fluids remain in the interstitial fluid.
Can you put that there, filter into the interstitial fluid? Is that okay?
Same thing. Yeah, that works.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or intracellular.
Yeah, they'll be in the interstitial first and the intracellular next.
Okay.
Good. Let's see. Number six, which pressure is responsible for filtration?
BHP.
Good. Number six is BHP. And number seven, responsible for reabsorption?
BOP.
Good. Number eight, what would happen to fluid transport if your hydrostatic pressure exceeded osmotic pressure at the venous end of the capillary?
There would be less reabsorption.
There'd be less reabsorption, and you would still continue to filter. Yeah, you'd have less reabsorption. You'd probably still be filtering. Okay, so number eight, they're less capable of reabsorption. You're probably more likely still filtering. So number nine requires some information that we haven't yet talked about. When fluids are pushed out of your capillary, sometimes proteins get pushed out as well. Those proteins get into that interstitial space. Normally, the lymphatic system will pick up escaped fluids and escaped proteins. It's really important that proteins get back into your bloodstream, because which pressure do they contribute to?
Osmotic pressure,
good. So knowing that background information, and we look at number nine and it says, if escaped proteins cannot be picked up by the lymphatic system, there's your pressure. Osmotic is the one that's primarily affected. Okay, so number nine, BOP is primarily affected. For number 10, what is your clue word? Is it proteins or fluid?
Fluid.
And this time, if you can't get fluids back into the capillary, now which pressure do you influence?
The BHP.
Yeah, the BHP, good. Let's see, number 11 is a pretty loaded question. You've got the liver here making plasma proteins like albumin. Why would liver disorders lead to edema?
Because if the plasma proteins happen to not make it to their capillaries and the insufficient fluid, or if there's a deficiency that causes more plasma proteins into the blood, then you have the capillaries swell and edema there.
Exactly, yes, yeah, so you'd be pulling too many fluids back in. Good. So in this case, where you've got not enough plasma proteins, then you're not capable of doing which process, filtration or reabsorption? Yeah, reabsorption, yeah. So that's the first question there. Why would liver disorders lead to edema? You're not capable of performing reabsorption. You have a low BOP. Okay, so that BOP becomes the issue. If you lose plasma proteins, or in any case, if you lose protein from the bloodstream, your BOP is affected, it's decreased, and you can't perform reabsorption at the venule end. Okay, number 12, how does high blood pressure, now this is BHP this time, how does high BHP promote edema?
Because more fluid will be pushing out into the interstitial fluid.
Push it out, yes. You've got a greater force pushing fluids into the interstitial space. And if you've got a high blood pressure, do you think you're capable of reabsorbing at the venule end? Maybe not. Yeah, so you may continue to do filtration at the venule end of your capillary. Okay, so number 12 there, high blood pressure forces more fluids out through filtration. It's unlikely you'll be able to reabsorb them through reabsorption at the venule end of your capillary. All right, number 13, drinking salt water. Yuck. What does that do to your blood osmotic pressure? Increases it. Good. And if you increase blood osmotic pressure, which process do you increase?
Reabsorption.
Reabsorption. So what happens to the fluids in your interstitial space?
It all comes into the capillary.
Comes into the capillary. And then your kidneys say, oh, look at all this extra fluid. I should get rid of it, right? And so there it goes out into your urine. All right, so number 14, let's take osmotic pressure. What would happen to osmotic pressure to promote extra fluids in your interstitial space, known as edema? Increase osmotic pressure or decrease osmotic pressure?
Decrease
osmotic pressure is right. That means you're incapable of doing what to those fluids?
Reabsorbing them,
that's right. And how about hydrostatic pressure? What might you do to hydrostatic pressure to push extra fluids out into the interstitial space? Increase it, good. So increase that hydrostatic pressure may cause edema or swelling. And then finally, number 15, what kind of situations may increase the return of fluids to the capillary at the venule end?
Low
BHP or high
BOP.
Yep, so those two situations. Low BHP, which is blood pressure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And high BOP.
I put like high sodium
volume. That'll do it, high sodium, high proteins. Yeah. Anytime you imbalance that fluid in that water. I'll let you guys read the information on the following page. Page 60 has edema explained at the top and some types of blood vessel issues at the bottom of the page, those disorders. And the blank down there you can actually find on stroke.org. Okay, so I'll leave that to you to read. So since we're talking about issues with hydrostatic and osmotic pressure, I wanted to show you this condition here. This condition is called quasicore, and it's related to malnutrition. These kids have swollen bellies, and their bellies are full of fluid. So the problem is the body is unable to reabsorb the fluid back into the venule end of the capillary. Which pressure is the one failing to pull the fluids back in? Yeah, that osmotic pressure. So what is missing from their diet that needs to be present to pull those fluids back in? It's primarily protein, yeah. So because they are probably not getting enough nutrition and because it's probably not protein-based nutrition, their bodies develop this problem of having a swollen, they call it ascites-type belly. Other people can have ascites. Look at this guy's belly. Look at the belly button pushed out there. That's huge, isn't it? So again, if you have chronic heart failure, left side or right side, you can develop ascites. Also, people who are alcoholics, you know, that don't eat, they rather to drink, they may develop this condition. Or somebody who's had gastric bypass surgery and doesn't eat enough protein to get it into their system. A lot of these things can cause decreased protein intake and excess fluids accumulate in the belly area. Okay. All right. So that was just a couple of things I'd like to share with you. And then do be sure to read page 60. I'd like to take you over to the lymphatic system.
I had a question.
Sure.
For the 60, I look for the symptoms in stroke. Is it FAST?
FAST is a good one. Okay. Yeah. There's several different acronyms they use, but that's certainly a good one to use. Hit the light for just a moment. Okay. So we talked about this stuff in class on Tuesday. I'd like to just kind of re-hit this stuff one more time. When we talk about hydrostatic and osmotic pressure, we know that we need a setup where we're pushing fluids at this arterial end of the capillary and reabsorbing fluids down here at the venule end of the capillary. Earlier today, I mentioned to you that this is not an entirely 100% efficient process of filtering and reabsorbing. About how much of that fluid gets reabsorbed at your venule end?
90%.
About 90%, yeah. Okay. And so the problem is, if you leave 10% of the fluid that used to be part of your blood plasma hanging out in your interstitial space, what happens to the interstitial space? It swells, right. And probably even bigger of a problem is the fact that you're not getting the fluids back in the bloodstream. How does losing fluids from the bloodstream affect your blood pressure?
It decreases it,
right. So it lowers your cardiac output. It lowers your blood pressure. Okay, so we have a kind of a catch-all system. It's called your lymphatic system. And its job is to pick up those escaped fluids and return them back to the capillary. So, unfortunately, this particular system picks up everything. It picks up cancer, it picks up bacteria, it picks up viruses. It's kind of like a drainage or a sewage system in that aspect, because everything in the interstitial space gets a ride in these very porous lymphatic vessels. So you'll see that these lymphatic vessels on a lot of these pictures are colored green. That's so we don't confuse them with red arteries or blue veins. But they're always closely associated with capillary beds. Mm-hmm. They're always hanging out there just to make sure they can pick up those escaped fluids. So when we're thinking about the lymphatic system's job of returning escaped fluids back to the cardiovascular system, we're thinking about this being kind of a drainage system, one that picks up fluids, gets them back to the cardiovascular, and maintains heart rate, blood pressure, cardiac output, all that good stuff. Okay, so because we may be picking up cancer cells or bacteria, this particular system also has to have a way to get rid of and destroy that stuff. So we do have a role in immunity for this system as well. All right. So you know how they call water inside a cell intracellular fluid? Mm-hmm. Water outside a cell is called extracellular fluid, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Water inside a lymphatic system is called lymph. So when we're looking at the content of lymph, we're actually looking at a bunch of stuff. We're looking at escaped blood plasma. We are looking at excess interstitial fluid. We may even pick up escaped proteins that got forced out of your capillary, and then we may see white blood cells. Why are white blood cells necessary here?
For the immune system.
Yeah, for that immune system response. Good. Notice that we don't really see red blood cells or platelets in this lymphatic system. They are not, you know, really supposed to leave the blood vessel because their jobs are confined to travel inside the bloodstream. So what is the main function of a red blood cell?
Carry oxygen.
Yeah, carry oxygen. And, you know, as a red blood cell, you don't do the body any good if you're drifting out in the interstitial space. So you need to stay inside the bloodstream. Likewise, what do platelets do?
Clot.
Yeah. And therefore, they should also stay in confined to that bloodstream, not out in the interstitial space, getting picked up by lymph. Okay. So these are the major lymphatic vessels in our bodies. And let me emphasize, they travel in one direction back towards your heart. These are closed-end vessels. They are not a circulatory system. They are not transporting lymph around your body like we think of with arteries and veins. These are basically a one-way ticket back towards your chest cavity and into your heart. So there is no circulation here. It's simply a drainage system that carries all these escaped fluids back to your heart. All right, so about halfway down your page, let's talk about lymph vessels in a little more detail. These lymph vessels are often thought of kind of like veins because veins have these same characteristics. Lymph vessels are thin-walled. Larger lymphatic vessels have valves to prevent what?
Backflow
of blood. And in the case here with our lymphatics, they're preventing the backflow of lymph. And of course, this is a low-pressure, pumpless system, so there is nothing behind this lymph to create the push to get it back to the heart. So this sounds pretty sad, doesn't it? You know, there's no pump. It's a one-way ticket to your heart. So how in the world do you get the lymph to move along?
Does it kind of just go with the flow of the blood?
Skeletal muscles, yeah. Yeah. So you physically being active and moving is what helps get this lymph back to your heart. Okay, so people who cannot move, maybe they're paralyzed, maybe they're bedridden, perhaps they just came out of surgery and have to stay confined, you know, in a pretty motionless state for some period of time, then we start to see lymph accumulate in the cells and tissues in that surrounding space, causing edema. So yeah, being physically active is the way to get this lymph back to your heart. So you're right, yeah, muscular pump, skeletal muscle activity will do it for us. Same thing, as for your cardiovascular system, take a deep breath. That makes the pressure in your chest cavity lower. When the pressure in your chest cavity is lower, lymph and blood both flow from high to low pressure, and they get returned back to your heart. We do have a little bit of smooth muscle in some of our larger lymphatic vessels. That helps to milk along the lymph towards your heart. But really, you're primarily relying on getting up and moving around. For instance, have you ever traveled on an automobile, maybe a plane ride, bus ride for a very long time, and you get off this vehicle and you look down, your legs are swollen? Okay? So the longer you sit and let gravity pull that lymph down to your extremities, the more likely you are to have some edema or swelling there. If you have the opportunity, what should you do every so often, 30 minutes, an hour or so? Move around. Yes, stretch, move around, get up and walk, get the blood pumping, right? Get that lymph moving back to the heart, and that helps to avoid things like these kinds of swelling issues. So, and when you're thinking about lymph capillaries, they're kind of like cardiovascular capillaries. They are draining into larger lymphatic vessels, kind of like veins. There's a lot of similarities here. The one-way ticket, though, for this system is just to be a drainage, basically a drainage basin back to your heart. So let's think about walking along a boardwalk or a busy street. If businesses want to invite you in, what do they do?
Hands out front. They send someone out there.
They put somebody out front. You ever walk past businesses and they've got the door propped open? And maybe something looks or sounds exciting inside, and maybe you would not have given a second glance into that business, but all of a sudden now you're interested and now you go in. Okay, that is what lymphatic capillaries do. They prop their doors open, just like a bar, and they say, hey, we're having a good time in here, come on in. And so once you come inside, guess what they do to those doors? They shut them. And so, I don't know about this bar, they kind of trap you on the inside. So you can see these things right here are little collagen fibers. They're like door stops. They basically prop the doors open. They invite the extra fluid in your interstitial space to travel through these tiny doors called mini valves. And once that fluid is stuck inside, those door props get released, the doors slam shut, and there you are. You're stuck inside a lymphatic capillary. You just got a free one-way ticket back to where? Back to the heart, right. If we don't return this fluid back to the heart, what impact will it have on cardiac output?
It'll decrease.
It will decrease it, right. And in response to a lowered cardiac output, what kind of receptor picks up on low blood pressure?
Baroreceptor.
Baroreceptor tattletales to your brain. Your vasomotor center, as part of your cardiovascular center, says, ooh, blood pressure's low. I will fix this by doing what?
Vasoconstriction,
exactly. So then your blood pressure goes up. Bingo. What does your cardiac center tell your heart to do?
Pump faster.
Yes. So SA node fires faster and your heart rate goes up too. Yep. So that's why we've got to get this fluid out of the interstitial space back to the heart. We've got to maintain blood pressure and heart rate. Otherwise, sympathetic nervous system kicks on. Okay. Very bottom of your page, I've got a couple of questions down there for you. What do you think happens to lymph if there is a blockage in a vessel, lymphatic vessel? Backflows, maybe get stuck, okay? And obviously it doesn't get back to your heart, right? Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't get back to your heart, what impact will it have on cardiac output?
It decreases.
Yeah, it ultimately decreases your cardiac output. So, yeah, you may backflow it if there's a blockage in the lymphatic vessel. And what ends up happening is you decrease cardiac output and blood pressure. Okay, so you can get that lymph back up, cardiac output and blood pressure will be lower. How about questions on that page?
So is the blockage, that's how you become septic?
Depends on what it is. I mean, if it's transporting bacteria, then that bacteria has to get into the bloodstream for you to be septic. Okay. Okay. Any questions on that page? All right. Top of page 63 talks about the pathway of lymph. Can you guys see that he is slightly green on that left side, below the right side? Okay, so you've got kind of a slightly green color to the right side of the head, right arm, right side of the chest cavity. That's because the drainage pattern here is actually asymmetrical. You know, when we think about blood flow, we think about equal size left and right. But in the case of lymphatic flow, we're looking at an uneven distribution of lymph flowing back to your chest cavity. In fact, your right arm, the right side of your head, and the right side of your chest cavity all flows back into a large lymphatic vessel on the right side of your chest cavity. The rest of your body, that includes the left side of your head, left side of your chest cavity, left arm, and both legs, actually travel into a large lymphatic vessel on the left side of your chest cavity. Both of these are going to drain into this junction between your subclavian vein and jugular vein. They don't show it in this model here, but there's a place right between where those two vessels join that your lymphatic vessels will basically butt in and start dumping lymphatic fluid into that subclavian vein. We know the route from the subclavian vein, whether you're on the right side or the left side, we travel through this vein here known as brachiocephalic, and then eventually your right into the SVC, and then you're back into the right atrium of the heart. So that's the catch with lymph. All of it has to make its way back to the chest cavity, and there's an uneven distribution of the way the fluids flow. Keep in mind that both legs go to which side of your chest cavity? The left one. Yep, so both legs go to the left side. And why they named it this way bugs me to no end, but you'll notice the lymphatic vessel on the right side in your worksheet is called a right lymphatic duct, and the one on the left side of your chest cavity is called a left thoracic duct. You know, pick a name and go with it, right? Okay, so they named the left and the right one something totally different. So this lymph that's traveling back to your heart contains some white blood cells, contains some proteins, but then we also contain some stuff that could potentially be harmful, like bacteria, viruses, even tumor or cancer cells can hitch a ride. So we need to make sure that before this lymph gets dumped into the bloodstream, that we have cleaned up the show. So we have lymph nodes scattered along our larger lymphatic vessels, and their job is to help clean this lymph, removing these items that could potentially be harmful. So lymph nodes are the cleaners, okay? They're the cleaning systems of our lymphatic system. They're scattered throughout your body, but there are several places that there's large collections of them. You do have a large collection around your head. We call these cervical lymph nodes. You can probably feel them around your chin. You may even be able to feel them at the back of your neck. They are loosely scattered in connective tissues. They're about an inch long, and they're about a kidney bean shape. Okay? We have them in the axillary region in the armpit area. Those drain, or of course, clean drainage coming from your arms back to your heart. And the inguinals around your legs are going to be cleaning lymph traveling from your legs back up to your heart. So that's not the only place you find these. You know, they're scattered along the aorta, for instance. They're scattered among a lot of our vital organs. But, you know, they're always trying to pick up and clean the lymph of these bad and potentially fatal items that are traveling through. Okay. In terms of lymph node structure, you'll notice that we have chambers on the inside, and these chambers help house lymphocytes. Those lymphocytes are going to help with the immune process. Why do you think it's important that if you're doing a job of cleaning, that you have chambers or rooms inside the cleaning structure?
Can't go everywhere.
Restrict the dirty stuff to a single chamber or room, and that way it doesn't spread and contaminate the whole lymph node. Now, if your lymph nodes are cleaning for you, and you may have experienced this, your lymph nodes may be painful and swollen. You ever had swollen, painful lymph nodes? Okay, so if you've got a head cold, for instance, you may have painful lymph nodes around your chin line. That is an indicator that they're simply doing their job and that they're cleaning like they're supposed to. The time we're supposed to be concerned about our lymph nodes is when they're swollen and not painful. What could that indicate? Cancer. Yeah, that could indicate cancer. So we know that cancer cells can get trapped, just like bacteria, in these little chambers. If the cancer cells set up a secondary residence inside of a lymph node, the name for that cancer is lymphoma. So oftentimes when, say, a woman is having a breast removed for breast cancer, they check the adjacent lymph nodes to make sure they too haven't picked up that cancer. Because if that's the case, then we understand now that it has metastasized to that secondary location. So there is a benefit of having lymph nodes. What is the benefit? They clean. Yeah, they clean stuff for us. And then the drawback, the negative? It can cause cancer. Yeah, so if they don't do their jobs, then of course they may become a secondary site for cancer, or they may spread something like bacteria. So I want you to notice for a moment on this picture, there are four afferent lymphatic vessels on the left side of this picture, and they've chosen to draw two efferent lymphatic vessels on the right side. The number isn't necessarily the important thing, it's how many of each you've got. The ratio there is what we're really looking at. You've got more afferent vessels coming into the lymph node than you do efferent vessels leaving the lymph node. That's an important thing to notice. If you have more toll lanes coming into a toll road than you do leaving, what happens once everybody's paid their toll fee?
Pressure to come out is greater.
Yeah, the pressure to come out means that everybody's funneled into just a couple of lanes. So what is the advantage for your lymph node by having more lanes in and less lanes out?
More time
to clean, exactly. So that's a benefit for us, the way that they're set up. All right, how about questions on lymph nodes or the drainage pattern? So the last page of the lymphatic system is covering some lymphoid organs. These are called lymphoid because they do play a role for your lymphatic system, but they may also play roles for other systems as well. So these lymphoid organs will play a role in immunity. They will have white blood cells like macrophages to eat bacteria. They also will have lymphocytes to fight and form immunity. So we're looking at some pretty powerful lymphatic organs here. Let's talk about your spleen first. The spleen is on the left side of your abdominopelvic cavity, and I've underlined for you the main roles of your spleen. First of all, it's a place where we clean blood. Okay, so by cleaning blood, we're removing things that could be toxic or dangerous to us to some extent, and also we're looking at removing worn out what?
Red
blood cells. So get those out of circulation. You'll notice the spleen also serves as a storage site for the breakdown products of platelets and red blood cells. So in the case of a hemorrhage, your spleen may donate these breakdown products to circulation in an attempt to maintain blood pressure and oxygen delivery. And then finally, you'll notice that the spleen stores platelets. So again, that helps to do clotting in case of a hemorrhage or a severe loss of blood. So the spleen is a membrane-bound organ. If the capsule surrounding your spleen is ruptured, then the spleen has to be removed. In the instance that the spleen is removed, what is the organ that plays the backup role?
The liver,
yep. So if the spleen can't function, the liver is the backup organ. All right, thymus gland is next. This particular gland sits over your heart and is most active during what time of your life?
Childhood,
right. What is it programming for us? What kinds of blood cells?
T cells,
good. White blood cells called T cells. And of course, these T cells are involved in forming antibodies and immunity. Okay, so that's the thymus gland. Then we have the tonsils. And this picture is actually wrong. I use it on purpose because it's a great conversation tool. there aren't five sets of tonsils, or actually there's five sets of tonsils, not six like you see here. You have a big mass at the top of your nasopharynx called the adenoids. You can't see them by looking in the mirror, but somebody can look through your nose and actually see them sitting at the back of your nasopharynx. This picture is drawn incorrectly because they show it like it's a pear, but in fact it's just one big mass back at the back of your nasopharynx. The two that you can see are the ones on either side of your throat. You can open up and say ah, mm-hmm. and they're oval shaped on either side of your throat. Those are what? What? Palatine. Yep, specifically palatine.
I don't have those.
Those are gone. Base of your tongue is another set. They're called linguals, yeah. So it used to be back in the 50s and 60s kind of the norm to take out your tonsils if you had sore throats and whatnot. Nowadays they take them out if they are what they call kissing tonsils, or basically ones that have been scarified with a bunch of scar tissue. So if they block your process of breathing, then they may consider taking them out. We better understand nowadays how important the tonsils are. What do they contribute to the lymphatic system?
They remove microbes,
yep. So what you breathe in through your mouth or your nose, or what you eat through your mouth, not your nose, of course is going to be filtered to some extent out by those tonsils. They do remove things like bacteria. There are white blood cells there to help fight infection. So they're kind of part of a line of defense that helps prevent items like bacteria from getting further into our respiratory systems.
So which one would you say will work on the most? Which one plays a bigger role in filtration in the mouth?
If I remember correctly, they do play different roles. If I remember correctly, it's the adenoids. Yeah.
I had thought about something, but it took my son's out, and I'm having a problem. Yeah,
they can grow back.
Yeah, they can.
Oh, that's they told me that they can grow back.
They're epithelial tissue, so yeah, there's some epithelial there that they can regenerate.
My best friend grew back.
Ooh.
So pretty.
How
old am I? 22. It's been like 15 years.
I see you were a kid when you had them out. Yeah.
Because that's really, really bad sleep apnea and asthma, and it was constricting my breathing because they were so swollen.
Ouch. Yeah.
So they had to remove them. They had no choice.
Ouch. At least you were young when you had it done, because the older you get, the more chance of bleed out can occur. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, we talk about the thymus gland basically retiring when you finish your teenage years. And, you know, we talk about it programming your T cells, which are part of that immunity response. You may wonder, okay, well, what if I encounter a new virus at age 30? You know, I don't have a thymus gland anymore at age 30. What am I going to do? Well, if you've got tonsils, the tonsils now become the place where T cells are programmed. So for those who have had their tonsils removed, right?
I'm just sitting here like, God, I'm not safe.
But you've got linguals, most likely, the base of your tongue, yeah.
I think they only took the palatine ones.
Yeah, their normal is what they call a TNA, a tonsillectomy, which is the adenoids, and adenoidectomy, or sorry, tonsillectomy, which is the palatines, and adenoidectomy above the nasopharynx.
It was only the palatine.
So people who don't have their tonsils and adenoids, they're like more susceptible to upper respiratory
infections? Quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
Which may be the whole thing that caused the tonsillectomy in the first place. Yeah. Probably. Unless it is, like in her case, unless it's blocking your air passage in the nose or the throat region. Yeah. So tonsils and something in your intestines called Peyer's patches are part of a system that we call a MALT system. So notice here that our respiratory and digestive tracts are trying to protect us from getting infected by whatever we breathe in or whatever we eat. So this MALT system, or a mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue system, is kind of a line of defense for protecting us. So in this picture, you see a couple of little pieces scattered around the intestines down here. Those are helping to prevent the absorption of bacteria into the bloodstream. So, you know, nowadays we hope that we're eating food that has been handled properly and is not going to make us sick. But, you know, say 100, 200 years ago, that may not have been the case. So those were probably quite important back before modern times, where we, you know, value cleanliness and proper food handling techniques.
So if you were to get like food poisoning, is that what kind of like rings the alarm for your purge?
Oh, what rings the alarm is you absorb the toxin, bacteria most likely. Mm-hmm. The medulla has no blood-brain barrier. It has an emetic center, and then it reads that and it says vomit.
Okay.
Yep.
It didn't say it's the vomiting sensor in 210.
Yep, it sure is. It's a pretty good bomb. Now we know it's a vomiting center and a cardiovascular center. So that's,
is that why you vomit when you're drunk too? Because it doesn't have a blood-brain barrier? So it's like...
That and the hypothalamus being a regulatory center, both of those have no blood-brain barrier. Yeah. Yep. So I promise this to be a short, sweet chapter. This was basically the end of this lymphatic system payers patches down at the very bottom of your page. What I'd like to do is just real quick show you some disorders of the lymphatic system. You know, the lymphatic system is supposed to pick up proteins, and if it can't, then you get edema in the interstitial space. If they take out lymphatic vessels, again, edema. This may accompany something like mastectomy. Be thankful you don't live in the part of the world that has this little worm. This worm is carried in conjunction with mosquitoes. You can see the yellow areas on the map here are homes to the mosquito and the worm. And the life cycle involves blockage of your lymphatic vessels. So these worms actually get into the lymphatic vessels, and you can't get the fluids to flow back in the lymph to the heart. So you can see, you know, both legs certainly is horrible, but this is just one leg that's got this elephantiasis condition. There's a foot and a leg with elephantiasis. This is treatable. If we can kill the worms with something like an antibiotic, we can get rid of that worm and hopefully open up those lymph flow pathways. It can also affect the scrotum. There are lymphatic vessels that drain sperm off the scrotum, so...
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Are you okay?
I don't think so.
How do they carry them out of bad ass?
Yeah.
Where are their genitals?
They're not okay.
Who married them?
No one.
What happened? I'm trying to figure out why all of them like that in that same area.
They must have lived near the worms.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So
that would be like,
that is so painful.
Oh, yeah, like in this part of Africa or South America. Or Southeast Asia, yeah.
So that
wow.
Can't get there.
Oh, it could have bitten them here. And then,
so that just traveled to...
They just traveled to that area. Yeah, they just got really unfortunate. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
So I know what's across from
you.
Yeah.
You have to, like, make a sling.
Wheelbarrow.
I'm just like, how do they walk? How do they sit? How do they function?
Very painful.
Yeah. And how much that must weigh to get around with.
Like, you need a wheelbarrow right here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awful.
So I wonder if after a while they're like desensitized because they're just so swollen, because they're already a sensitive part to begin with. I can imagine. Either it completely goes away and you don't feel it because there's like so much, or they're like extremely sensitive. And I'm sure all those people are very cranky.
Oh, I'm sure they are. Yeah. Imagine even just trying to urinate with that.
That's what I asked. How do they pee?
Yeah.
Where is it?
I think it's
back up in there, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh,
yeah. You want to look at something different. Okay, so we're done with content for Tuesday's test. Now I'd like to open the floor. You guys can review anything, everything that you want to. Why don't we start back with heart? Any topics there you'd like to review?
Can we go over the stuff that we did on Monday?
Monday we did this stuff here, and we did blood pressure regulation on Monday. Do you need this, or does this make sense?
I have no idea what's going
on. Okay.
I'm going to go back and listen to the whole lecture, but it's better whenever I can like ask questions.
Since we're here, let's just do this. Okay, so first of all, this is bulk fluid transport at the capillary. And what we mean by bulk fluid transport is, you know, there's a lot of exchanges that can occur at a capillary. You can have gas exchange, nutrients, waste products, but we're just focusing on how pressures regulate fluid exchange at the capillary. Okay, so there's two pressures we have to pay attention to. One is called hydrostatic pressure, the other one is called osmotic pressure. And hydrostatic pressure is based upon fluids in the capillary, which basically is blood plasma. And this particular pressure is going to push fluids, and it's equal to blood pressure. Okay, so, you know, we've changed the language, and we used to call it blood pressure, but in this story we call it blood hydrostatic pressure. The battling pressure is called osmotic pressure, and use that word osmosis because we always said that water follows
salt.
So this is salts, solutes, proteins that creates this pressure. And you know, when we talk about water following salt, what we really mean is that water is being pulled toward the saltiest content or compartment. Okay, so pulling pressure. So this is the battle. We've got pushing hydrostatic pressure and we've got a pulling osmotic pressure inside the capillary. Because blood pressure is fairly high at the arterial end at 35 millimeters mercury, and because osmotic pressure is low at 26, the higher number wins the battle. So we say at the arterial end of your capillary, hydrostatic pressure is effective in forcing fluids out. What do we call that process?
Filtration.
Yeah, filtration occurs at the arterial end of your capillary. Why does hydrostatic pressure drop over the length of your capillary? It's filtering out. Yeah, you're pushing out fluids, you're losing them to the interstitial space. And then, of course, we're looking at a lower BHP at the venule end of your capillary. All right, so BHP is around 15 to 17 at the venule end. Osmotic pressure tends to stay fairly stable. So down here, once again, the higher pressure wins the battle. This time, osmotic pressure wins. And what happens to the fluids in the interstitial space? Suck them back in. Yep. So we call this process down here reabsorption. You ever have one of those days where you can't spell? This is one of those days.
Yeah,
it's
every day.
It's every day. Sorry. You know what I mean? I can't spell it today. It's just one of those days. There's a P in there. It's like it's not looking right. Absorption.
After the R.
That, yeah, that looks good.
Oh, okay. Sophia. That looks great.
We'll just leave it
there. Don't feel bad.
I'm a science
language. English.
I can do it.
Formula.
Yes.
But you asked me to read like a 3-page thing. I'm like,
oh, same here. Those standardized tests where you have to read a paragraph and answer questions. I'm like, yeah, it looks good. Flip the page.
Yeah.
No novels, no, none of that stuff.
I read a whole sentence wrong last night trying to do my research paper. And I was sitting there like, that doesn't look like correct English. My eyes, they weren't reading vasectomy right. Like, no, it was reading the name right. The name was Veneris, and I was reading vasectomy. I was like, Why would vasectomy ride a dragon? I don't understand. That was me for at least a whole minute.
Your brain messes with you, doesn't it?
I was so angry. I was like, why?
I didn't say umbilical, and then I knew it was umbilical, but I was like,
it's like your brain takes a trip somewhere.
Yeah.
So with reabsorption, that word, 90% gets pulled back in. The other 10% of the fluid, where does it go?
It goes
It's in the interstitial space. We want to pick it up with those lymphatic vessels because that prevents a condition known as
edema.
Yeah. So that lymphatic vessel has doors propped open. It's very encouraging to let fluids come in.
Extra fluid.
Yeah, if you don't do this, it's like 3 liters you'll accumulate in your interstitial space. So that was part of what we did on Tuesday. The other part of what we did was blood pressure regulation. Do y'all have questions on that? You feel pretty good with that? So if I have low blood pressure, what kind of receptor picks up on that problem?
Baroreceptor,
good. If I've got high levels of carbon dioxide, what kind of receptor?
Chemoreceptor.
If I've got high blood pressure, what kind of receptor?
Baroreceptor.
If we are telling the cardiovascular center in your brain that we have low blood pressure, it responds by turning on sympathetic nervous system. And if you turn on the sympathetic nervous system, your heart rate will
increase
and your blood vessels will
constrict.
Good, so blood pressure increases too. Let's see, if we've got too much oxygen, kind of hard to believe, right? But you can have it, you can have too much oxygen. What kind of receptor picks up on this?
Chemoreceptor,
good. How about low CO2 levels?
Chemoreceptor.
Let's do that one. If you've got low CO2 levels, you come to your brain with that information, and your brain says, this time we're going to increase
parasympathetic,
good. And parasympathetic nervous system tells your heart rate to
slow down.
What does it tell your blood vessels to do?
It can't tell your vessels to do anything.
Bingo. Yeah, there's no parasympathetic innervation to vessels. All you can do is shut off sympathetic innervation. Yeah. You know that, right? Okay. Sure. Let's do another one. Let's say that we have low oxygen levels. What kind of receptor picks up on this?
Chemoreceptors.
Your cardiovascular center says we should do something to fix it. We should
increase the breathing rate.
Yeah, if you've got low oxygen, increased sympathetic stimulation, that will cause your heart rate and your blood pressure to
increase,
right? And of course, your breathing goes along with it. You feel pretty okay with that topic?
Okay.
Sure.
And then we have neurochemical and hormonal.
Yeah.
AMP is the only one that will decrease blood pressure, right?
Yeah, in terms of hormones. If you're talking chemical, then we're talking something like histamine, nitrous oxide.
I remember histamine DMP for that later. Nitrous oxide as well?
Nitrous oxide as well, yeah.
If the parasympathetic is being triggered, then there's no
vessel.
You could say increase parasympathetic while decreasing sympathetic.
Okay.
Yeah.
So no vasoconstriction.
Let's see. If your problem, let's go back to our issue, was high levels of oxygen, then you're going to increase parasympathetic stimulation to your heart and decrease sympathetic stimulation to your vessels.
Okay. So.
Don't mess with the vessels.
Yeah.
Blood vessels have no brake pedal.
Yeah.
Wait, okay, so, sorry, I'm reading this question. The parasympathetic nervous system activity promotes the release of
acetylcholine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I have a question for the possible essays.
Okay.
Your blood flow will be warm.
Definitely blood flow. Be comfortable starting anywhere in the pathway.
Okay. This is going to sound wrong. I'm going to study all of them, but which one of the disorders should I study more for? Like, anything as far as like edema with having to do with BHP and GLP?
We'll that later on in fluid electrolyte balance, so not so much an issue now.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, just know the basics there, because we'll take it a step further in chapter 25.
Basically,
just know that part. And don't worry about the numbers, because I'm not going to ask you numbers. Net filtration pressure would be the only thing I would ask you off that picture. 10 on the left side arterial end and -8 on the venule end. Other essays, I would look at how an EKG is set up. That negative feedback loop with the baroreceptors and chemoreceptors, I'd feel comfortable answering your question if I gave you some problems. If you're talking about baroreceptors and chemoreceptors, be comfortable. If I said, I've got this problem, how do I fix it? Be comfortable walking me through those steps. That's three of them. That'll give you three at least. And there's two more on there, so.
Okay,
EKG, baroreceptor, chemoreceptor, that whole business, and blood flow. And if you feel comfortable talking about these kinds of pressures here, that's, you know, certainly something that will be on there. Yeah, BHD, BOP, be able to talk about those. Anything I can help you with from old stuff, maybe heart or anything from blood vessels? Number in the course pack, essay note, AD note, bundle of HIS, bundle of branches, that way.
Okay.
Yeah, like what contracts in response to what, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the commonality is the only
that switches? Yes, that's which is the vessel color, yeah. Or what type of transporting.
Will we have to do some of the math behind cardiac output?
I would know that EDV, ESV, and cert volume can be subtracted easily without a calculator. I won't make you guys calculate cardiac output because that requires a calculator. Give you a picture and say, just name it. That's all you got to do. You do not have to explain what's wrong with it.
Okay.
And the layers of the heart wall.
I may say to you, for the layers of the heart wall, what is the most superficial layer, which is fibrous, or what is the deepest membrane, which is the visceral? Yeah, or I may say to you, which two layers produce serous fluid? I may say to you, what is superficial to the parietal, which is fibrous, what is deep to the parietal, that's visceral. Yes, you want to be comfortable toggling between those three. Those will be just a picture. All you have to do is name the abnormal EKG. You don't have to describe it or identify what's wrong with it.
So most of the tests is going to be on cardiovascular and the heart?
Yeah. Actually, it's split between cardiovascular and blood vessels and blood pressure regulation, all that good stuff. Lymphatics are a very small portion.
For the cardiac cycle stages, in order, you need to know them in order? As it's written in the course pack?
More or less, know them in order because they go to a particular phase of the cycle. So, yeah, that would probably be good to know them in that right order. Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, nothing in particular comes first. Like in the beginning, we know if you start off with atrial systole, it has to go all the way down to mid to late ventricle diastole.
Right, and you can pick anywhere as your starting point in that cycle. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So change the heart, like the ventricle, the hip, and just kind of like, you know, the person that can describe it.
the ventricles. I'm going to say to you which one has the capability of discharging blood to the aorta. Or I might say to you which chamber receives blood from the pulmonary veins. Yeah. Yeah, so that's kind of where you want to be with that. Does this stuff seem easier than endocrine? Okay. Yes, it's not like all that memorization of endocrine. Anything I can review for you, go back through, or answer questions on?
Are we going to need... Just know everything about the like what happens when you play.
Yeah, can you wait all the ways? Know what happens, know what part of the intrinsic conduction system fires to cause the wave. Yeah. If you get home and you get stuck, email me. I check email throughout the weekend. Monday I'm downtown at the Health Sciences campus. If you want to talk in person, I'm down there. Usually around 10:30, 11 o'clock, I'll be in F204 downtown. I'm also in my office on Tuesday mornings before class, and if anybody is just dying to get started early, I'll be happy to come down here and get you guys rolling.
Is there also awesome?
I've got two tests over there, so if you want to take one over there, I've got one over there with a blank. And there's no name on it, so it could be yours. Yeah. Good luck studying.